Illinois was home to several competitive House races last year. Two of them flipped to the Democratic Party. Today, we'll look at freshman Representative Sean Casten and Lauren Underwood and the challengers they might face next election day. Plus, Leland is a village of 900 people in LaSalle County, but recently it's become home to a dispute between two banks. We'll learn why. And we'll speak with Adam Rigasia about how he went from journalism professor to YouTube cooking star.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, most small towns are hoping to hold on to the one bank they might have. We're going to talk about the town of Leland in northern Illinois, where two banks are fighting over one town. But first, it's been just 8 months since the 2018 midterm elections. Remember that? But congressional candidates are already gearing up for the 2020 House races next November. You might recall that in 2018, there were several competitive districts here in Illinois, and on Election Day, two congressional seats flipped to the Democratic Party. Lauren Underwood unseated Republican Randy Holtgren in the 14th District, and Sean Casten, another first-time candidate for Congress, was the first Democrat to be elected in Illinois' 6th District in decades. And in the 13th District, Democrats came very close to flipping a third seat in the race between Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan and Republican incumbent Congressman Rodney Davis. Well, now freshman Representatives Casten and Underwood are already getting ready to defend their seats, and in the 13th District, Londrigan has already announced she's going to try again to unseat Davis in 2020. Here to tell us more about these races is Jim Fuller, a reporter at the Daily Herald who's been reporting on Representative Underwood's campaign. Also joining us from the Daily Herald's Marie Wilson, a reporter who's been following Representative Sean Casten. And joining us from Springfield to talk about what appears to be round two of the Davis-Londrigan race in 2020 is Bernie Schoenberg, a political writer and columnist with the State Journal Register. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good day.
Thank you.
Bernie, I wonder if we could.
Good morning.
Bernie, I wonder if we could start with you and some news over the weekend. The Illinois Republican Party, this is now making national news today, doing some damage control after a post to the Illinois Republican County Chairman's Association Facebook page. It was a fake movie poster that referred to four female Democratic congresswomen of color as, quote, the Jihad Squad. The representatives in that photo were Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. First, what are the leaders of the Illinois Republican Party saying about this, Bernie?
They are condemning it as a very bad idea, not representative of the party. They don't want to look like they are being racist or taking on a religion. Of course, jihad is a very loaded term these days in the age of terrorism, you know, holy war, Muslims, that kind of a thing. And of course, the top picture in the very well done fake movie poster is Ilhan Omar, who, you know, wears a headscarf. So it is being condemned by the chairman of the Republican Party, Tim Schneider. Even the chairman of the County Chairs Association, who also has a top position with the state Republican Party structure itself, Mark Shaw of Lake County, said that while the post was up from Friday until at least Sunday afternoon on his organization's Facebook page, he says it was put on by an unauthorized person. He is sorry if anyone was offended, and they took it down, and they're going to re-examine the process they have. I guess there's five people or something who are authorized to post things to that site under the name of the organization. So it's a big embarrassment. I was alerted to this by a colleague of mine in the early afternoon on Sunday, and I looked on the Facebook page, and there were more than 400 comments, and I did not see one that was for it. It was a lot of people saying, I used to be a Republican, I'm mad at you. So damage control indeed is what they're doing. The leadership of the party says that. We have not heard who posted this yet.
And Bernie, this does, in a way, relate to the conversation we're having about these reelection campaigns, because I wonder what we're hearing from candidates. First of all, I know Jeannie Ives is mounting a campaign against Representative Sean Casten. Have we heard from any Republican candidates so far about how they're feeling about this?
Well, there are some out there who may have commented in my district, Rodney Davis, who has an appearance actually this morning or around noontime in Springfield, has not commented on this. What's interesting is this grows out of what President Trump tweeted, a week ago about the three or the four members of the quote-unquote squad, these freshman Democrats in Congress.
Which is the name they gave themselves to, we
right.
should say.
And they were fighting with Nancy Pelosi, their own leader, and then President Trump stepped in and told them to go back where they came from or go back to the war-torn, et cetera, the bad countries, despite the fact three of them were born in America. But at that time, Rodney Davis was one of the few who said something critical. He said, "While I strongly oppose many of the positions advocated by my colleagues and their statements about law enforcement, I disagree with the rhetoric used by President Trump. Personal attacks do more harm than good and allow the negative consequences of policies being pushed by far left members of the Democratic caucus to be ignored." So he did the same thing when the president said there were good people on both sides of the Charlottesville situation, where you had white nationalists marching, Nazi flags, etc. He is willing to say that that is the wrong way to go. And he said at that time, and that was, I think, during the state fair a couple of years ago, he had said there's no place for, people of the alt-right in our party. So he's able to go that far, but I haven't heard any condemnation yet about what just happened. But I'm sure that most members of the Republican Party, especially given the outcry that this fake movie poster, the Jihad Squad, has caused, will be saying it was a really bad idea.
And certainly this is a story that is pretty recent. I wonder, Jim, your district's represented by Democrats Lauren Underwood and Sean Casten. Have they spoken out either about this post or I know they've been, Lauren Underwood has been pretty vocal about President Trump.
Right. And as you said, it is pretty recent, just happening, within the last day or so. And so I haven't seen Lauren Underwood say anything about the poster specifically, but she was part of a large number of Democrats who voted in favor of a House resolution just this last week, condemning those, sort of go back to where you came from comments that President Trump had made that you folks were just speaking about. And, she's been pretty vocal on President Trump in general, as well as the topic of, immigration, given her position on the Homeland Security Committee.
And I wonder what you can tell us about what Lauren Underwood's freshman year so far has been like in Congress in terms of what she's been working on, what good she's made, if she has been able to, on different issues she campaigned on.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, she came into the election with a nursing background, which is something that's actually been attacked and questioned by various members of the Republican Party or the party itself, kind of calling her out as like a quote unquote fake nurse because she never served in like an emergency room or like an urgent care or anything like that. She's been a nurse who's done some teaching. She's done a lot of research. She worked on the Flint water crisis in Michigan, that sort of thing. So she came to the campaign with healthcare, as really her main issue. There was a time when, if you think back to, previous sessions where, we were seeing lots of votes to, repeal the Affordable Care Act, various forms of that. And Lauren Underwood really came forward saying, that's the wrong way to go. What we need to do is, strengthen this while we figure out a better long-term solution. So she's been, putting forth, various bills, in the House to, enhance and protect things like pre-existing conditions. That's part of her own personal narrative as somebody who has a pre-existing heart condition. She's also worked on legislation to improve, veterans' access to health care. And also one of the other things she sort of champions is, protections for children of abuse. So she's really focused in, zeroed in on health care, and that was kind of her promise all along. You know, the question is, how much that will resonate with the district when she runs for reelection.
Right, and just to follow up, so she is a registered nurse. Our very helpful producers
Correct.
Are telling us she received her BSN from the University of Michigan and her MSN from and a master's in public health. She's a MSN
That's
and
correct.
A master's in public health from Johns Hopkins University.
Right.
Thanks for that, Jim. So, Marie, when we're thinking about Sean Kasten, another seat that flipped, he very much campaigned on being a green energy entrepreneur. And I wonder how he's followed through on that platform in his first few months in Congress.
Yes. Well, speaking with Sean Kasten recently, he was able to tell me about a couple of bills that he has worked with other legislators to introduce that he says will go far to address some of the underlying issues related to climate change. And one of those bills would help increase storage on the electric grid for renewable energy so that when renewable energy is generated, it has somewhere to go. And he says that another of the bills would require companies, all public companies, to disclose more information to investors on the ways that climate change could affect their bottom line. So those bills, Representative Kasten told me, are both in discussions in various committees, but he feels that he is bringing the expertise he's built from his career in the environmental industry to Congress, and he thinks that he is making progress on those issues.
And Marie, when we think about this 6th district, this is flipped from Republican to Democrat when Sean Kasten was elected. Who is he facing now? Who's already said that they want to challenge him in 2020?
Yes, well, the newest news in the 6th district is it does appear that there will be a Republican primary because the first announced opponent who wants to go against Representative Kasten is Evelyn Sanguinetti, who's the former lieutenant governor for former Governor Bruce Browner. And she announced her campaign in April. But then last week, another candidate on the Republican side has also entered the race, and that is Jeannie Ives. She's a former candidate for governor who ran against Governor Browner in the Republican primary last year, and she's also a former state representative in from the Wheaton and DuPage County area. So those two are lining up to be on the Republican side, both wanting and both already looking forward to facing Kasten.
And Marie, what can you tell us in terms of the district? I believe I mentioned this at the beginning. Sean Kasten was the first Democrat to be elected in the Illinois 6th district in decades.
Yes. Since 1972 to 2018, the district was represented by Republicans. It is a traditionally conservative area. It makes the shape of a C at this point and covers a large area of the western and northwestern suburbs, from Naperville area on the south side of the district up to the Barrington area on the north side. So for the past 12 years of that time as a traditionally Republican district, it was represented by Peter Roskam, who most recently was known as one of the architects of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And he had a reputation in the district for working on those types of issues, but he faced a coalition, a strong campaign of Democratic groups in the last election cycle that really were not happy with his views on healthcare or on climate and wanted to get him out of Congress, and was able to work and end up back in Kasten.
And Bernie, that's also true of the 13th district where Rodney Davis is. That includes Springfield, where you are, Champaign-Urbana, where I am right now. Can you, Ryan, remind us the politics of the 13th district in terms of the voter makeup, what that looks like?
It's actually split. We all think it was designed to be kind of a 50-50 district. Rodney Davis was able to win a very close race in his first run in 2012 against a doctor from Bloomington. and David Gill, and then he had some easy races for a couple of cycles, and this last time he lost. He won by less than 1% against Betsy.
Less than 1%. It was a few thousand votes. Was it a few thousand votes, if I'm remembering correctly,
Bernie? Well, let's see. It was 136,516 to 134,458. So 50.38 to 49.62%. So it was very close. Londrigan, who has a good family name in Springfield, her mom used to be in charge of, I think, all of the volunteers at the Presidential Library Museum, very well known, that kind of a thing. She has stressed health care. Rodney Davis was among people who claims adamantly that he is for protecting people with pre-existing conditions. He talks about his wife's past illness, being a cancer survivor 20 years ago, a lot. But Londrigan talks a lot about her son, Jack, who I believe is at U of I now or may have just graduated. But he, when he was about 12, got bitten by a tick, nearly died with the illness that he got, Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And Londrigan basically says healthcare is the most important thing to me and to people in this district, because if we didn't have good insurance, we would have gone bankrupt. So Davis had voted many times to end Obamacare, claims that the Republican plans would have adequate protections. Londrigan stresses that Davis voted to end Obamacare and that the Republicans don't really have a plan if you look at where President Trump is and where what Congress has done under Republican control. So that's a big issue. And we'll see how it plays out again. It's very interesting. President Trump slightly won the district last time, very popular in the rural areas. But there's also 8 college campuses, including the U of I, where students
ISU and UIS within this district.
Yeah. So you have a lot of college students that may or may not be energized. It's very they both play a very interesting game with President Trump. Londrigan does not stress certainly impeachment or anything about it. She says we've got to discuss issues. We're not going to be painted as she had to say already she's not a socialist, because when she announced this time, the Republicans came out and said, oh, she's with all of those socialists. And she said, that is not me at all. Davis, uses some of that. But he interestingly, after the Access Hollywood tape came out just before the election 2016, said he can't vote for either Hillary or Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Remember, because he withdrew his endorsement and resigned
his endorsement
from the Agricultural Committee.
Right. But then when I asked him, during the campaign last year, did you vote for Donald Trump? He would not say, because Trump is too popular with some people. He said, well, Bernie, who did you vote for? I'm not going to say. I said,
Bernie,
I'm not
let me stop you for a second there. You don't have to answer that question. Let me stop you for a second. We're going to take a break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and right now we're talking about the 2020 House races next November, potential challengers to two freshmen who took seats from Republicans in the 2018 midterm elections. We've been talking about the 14th District and Lauren Underwood, Sean Casten in Illinois' 6th District, and the 13th District. Bernie Schoenberg's with us at our partner station, WUIS. He's with the State Journal Register. Jim Fuller is a reporter with the Daily Herald, along with his other Daily Herald colleague, Marie Wilson. And I wanted to ask you guys, we talked about Sean Casten's potential opponents, Rodney Davis's potential opponents. But Jim, I wanted to ask you about Lauren Underwood. Who's potentially challenging her?
Well, maybe the better question is who isn't challenging Lauren Underwood at this point in time. I think at one point we were up to like 8 or 9 for a while, and then you kind of wait and see who's really serious about it. But in some ways, it's a mirror image of what we saw when Lauren Underwood won, when we had 7 Democrats in the primary, and she kind of came out of that pool. It looks like we're going to have at least a similar pool on the Republican side this time around. Some of the more well-known names would be people like State Senator Jim Oberweis, who actually tried to run for the same office about a decade ago. We have people like State Rep Alan Skillicorn, who has not fully committed yet, but he keeps talking like he's interested in running. And then you even have people like you know, State Senator Sue Rezin, the assistant Republican leader who doesn't even actually live in the 14th congressional district, talking about wanting to run for the seat. So as you can tell,
she better move quickly,
Republicans...
right? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I believe you don't actually even have to live in the district to run for the office. It's a weird quirk of the Constitution, but for sure that would be an issue. So yeah, there's a wide range of potential options in the Republican primary, and that just goes to show how vulnerable the Republicans think the seat is.
And when we think about how much health care has been part of the conversation, whether it's Lauren Underwood or Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, Bernie, I just wanted to end by asking about that, about issues. I mean, I wonder how much, I feel like we've heard a lot about immigration. I wonder how much we're going to hear discussions again about health care as 2020 comes around. What are you hearing so far, Bernie?
Well, when Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan announced again that she's running this year, and by the way, last time she had win a five-way primary. So far, nobody has announced in a primary against her this time, and she may have headed that off. But she said health care is the top issue. Again, she's not stressing Trump because this is an area where the president is somewhat popular. So she is saying, let's keep Obamacare and fix it. She likes the idea of a public option, especially for smaller towns or rural areas. That, of course, is on the Davis side. They're saying Republican plans are better. We need to scrap Obamacare and do something better, protect pre-existing conditions. And they conflate because of something Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan said once about eventually, you know, this might be a path to single payer. They have linked her with Nancy Pelosi. They even linked her with Speaker Madigan, which was very specious last time because he had voted for some kind of a statewide plan 10 years ago, had been a co-sponsor of a plan that didn't even get a vote on the House floor in Illinois. But they put Madigan's picture with Pelosi's picture and with Londrigan's picture in the same ad, if I'm remembering it right. That kind of thing is going to happen again. They're going to say she's just like all these radical Democrats. She says she's not. She's not for single payer now for everyone. So it will be a big issue, though, she says, when she has town halls. And if she does like last time, she'll probably have a bunch of them because Rodney Davis says, I'm not going to just let myself get heckled. I'm going to be on the radio a lot. I'm going to meet with groups that are interested. And it's frustrating for his opponents because he doesn't do the traditional town hall. On the other hand, there's so much pent up, you know, interest in this race from the progressive side that a town hall could be rather raucous if he has one. So we'll see what happens. But healthcare is going to be big, and both sides will stress it, saying very different things. And we'll see who people believe and what they want.
And we'll see how this race unfolds. Bernie Schoenberg will be covering it for the State Journal Register. I want to thank him, Marie Wilson, Jim Fuller from the Daily Herald. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Most small towns would love getting the attention of just one bank, but one town in LaSalle County is getting lots of attention from two. Leland is a village of a little more than 900 people, and last year, First Midwest Bank closed its branch there. That closure set off a dispute over who would get to take over the space. The mayor even got involved. Now, Leland is home to two branches from two different banks, both vying for Leland's customers. We found out about this because Steve Daniels reported on it for Crane Chicago Business. He's joining us now. But we also wanted to talk about the state of banking in Illinois' smaller towns with Carol Jo Fritz. She's president of First Neighbor Bank, which has 9 locations in central and southern Illinois. She's joining us from Toledo, about an hour south of Champaign. Mike Doherty is also with us this morning as a senior economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau. All of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Steve, I wondered if we could start with this story in Leland. So this is a village, we said, of about 900 people. Who are the banks? What are the banks that are now fighting over Leland, if that's the right way to describe it?
It is, I think, the right way to describe it. And the banks are Resource Bank out of DeKalb, which is a little bit north, and then Pioneer State Bank out of Earlville, Illinois, a smaller bank than Resource, which is... a little bit west.
And why did the, how did, do we know why this is happening?
Well, not entirely. That's one of the things that I enjoyed about the story was that it still remains a little mysterious as to what all happened here, but probably worth a quick synopsis. So First Midwest Bank had had a branch in Leland for many years. It had been predecessors that had been there before that. Leland's been served by, had a bank in town for over 100 years. Until First Midwest announced plans to close it among a wave of other branch closures that they were doing. Soon thereafter, Resource Bank approached First Midwest, which had put its bank building on the market, about buying the building, and were refused over and over again. And they offered substantially more than First Midwest was asking and still were refused. So they decided to move into town anyway, set up what effectively was like a mobile trailer with a branch there. And then First Midwest found a different bank that was interested in its building, and that was Pioneer, which agreed to purchase it for $100,000, which was some $400,000 less than Resource had offered. Pioneer then set up a loan shop only, not deposits, just loans, farm loans. And then Resource went about buying another building in town, an old horse saddle maker from way back when, that they're going to revamp into a bank branch. So
Steve, I mentioned this is somewhat unusual, right?
It's
kind of
unusual.
A curious story, but then I wonder also how unusual it is when we look across the across Illinois, and we're thinking particularly of our smaller towns. I imagine most of them don't. Like, what does it look like in terms of how many banks exist?
Well, the bank president you got on can probably speak to that a little bit better than I can, since I do focus on the Chicago market much more so. But certainly in the part of northern Illinois that where Leland is, what we have seen is remarkable stability in terms of how many banks are there, how many bank branches are there. And that is in contrast to much of the rest of the country, where banks are closing up shop in rural areas, and oftentimes people in those towns have to drive 50 miles or something to find the nearest bank. So it's curious. Illinois is not following the trend that's occurring elsewhere, at least, again, up in the northern part of the state.
Carol Jo Fritz, as I mentioned, you're the president of First Neighbor Bank. You have 9 locations in both central and southern Illinois. Do you agree with Steve Daniels in terms of thinking about Illinois perhaps being a little bit different than the national trend when it comes to smaller towns and banks?
Well, we still have, we're a different cat, I think, because we focus on the smaller communities. But it's interesting to me in this story that you have 2 banks, and one of those banks is a fairly large bank. So, but the trends themselves here in Illinois and downstate, what we've seen here has been the larger mega banks that are closing their branches. That's what we're seeing.
And so
we're seeing the same thing.
Right.
Downstate as they are.
What about with what you do? What kind of services do you provide for residents in the towns you operate in?
We provide, I was talking earlier with someone and telling them today, we provide a down payment plus program, which is funded through the Federal Home Loan Bank. And then we also have rural development loans, which is funded through FSA and USDA. The Farm Service Agency. So Down Payment Plus allows people to have up to $6,000 of basically free money if they stay in their home for 5 years or more. And so we have those programs. Of course, we sell our mortgages on secondary market, Freddie Mac, and everything like that. But those are the programs that we have that actually can help the rural residents out.
Mike Doherty is also with us. He's a senior economist at the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mike, when we think about particularly rural areas, Steve mentioned one bank being open for agricultural loans. How much does agriculture play a role in keeping banking going across Illinois?
It really depends on which counties you're looking at. We have counties in downstate Illinois that are very, very dependent on agriculture. You take a look at some of these. We call it the Golden Triangle, which is going kind of north from Bloomington toward Chicago and to the east or the Grand Prairie areas there. Some of those counties and also down in southern Illinois and also over in western Illinois, you'll find counties that don't have a large employer outside of or a large sector of employment, no large manufacturer other than agriculture other than farming. And so in some of those counties, it's very significant.
And when we're farmers in particular, I wonder how important it is to have a local bank in their town.
You know, the relationship between farmers and their local banks, especially in Illinois, where we've always have stood out from the national average for having a large number of community banks and small town banks. The relationship between these the farmers and their banker goes back a long ways. And that's important because a farm, if you look at the top five reasons a farm might fail as a business, a couple of those reasons oftentimes are personal management problems or family conflict problems. These are family-owned businesses. They're small. You got two or three families oftentimes working and managing that farm. And so to have a banker who knows your family and has been kind of there for you and making loans and knows your farming methods and you know your knowledge level as a farmer, that's very important, and they can work with you during the lean. Remember, farm income goes up and down quite a bit, especially this year where it's down. And so to have a banker, a lender that goes back sometimes two, three generations with your family farm. Remember, most of our farms here in central Illinois got started in the 1870s, so they're quite. They've been in business a long time under the same family name, and so to have that relationship is pretty important.
Carol, I mentioned how important is that relationship for you all from a bit from the banking side?
Oh, very. And we are an ESOP company, so we have a lot of people that stick around, and our customers love that. I've been here at our bank for 44 years, and my senior lender's been with us for 32 years. So
wow.
We have a lot of longevity.
Yeah, that's impressive,
yeah.
Carol.
Thank you. But we have a lot of longevity in our company, and our customers all know us, and we all have good relationships. We know their families. We know their kids. We know we have different generations of farming that, like was said before, and so it's very, very important, and we're able to help those people and help their kids when they go off to college and just do a lot of different things for them, so very important.
So, Carol Jo, what happens then when a bank closes? What happens to a community from your perspective?
Well, it's usually not good for the community. I was in a small town in Illinois. Oh, it's been a few years back now, but I was with another banker, and we were walking down the street, and we saw a gentleman, and he said, hey, to the other banker I was with, and he said, are you going to open a bank back in town? And we were walking by the bank building that was closed, and he said, well, I don't know, and he goes, well, I was going to say, if you do, could you serve sandwiches out of one window, and could you have money at the other one, because we don't have any place to eat here in town either. And I think that that's an indication of what may happen if you don't have the support of a community bank in a small town.
Steve, so, yeah, as Carol Jo sharing that story, Steve, I wonder if you think particularly the national trend is what Carol's saying, as we see smaller towns and losing their bank, how much that then has a ripple effect throughout the rest of the town's economy.
Yeah, banking is it's interesting because we're obviously seeing a lot of bank branches close in the Chicago area. And a lot of times the banks will say, well, you know, people don't come to the branch. And maybe Carol can speak to this a little bit down in her experience. But, routine transactions are handled remotely. That's why you're seeing so many branches close is because essentially they're very expensive sort of brick and mortar billboards in a sense. So, but in the small towns, certainly like and Leland, I got to know a little bit about doing the story. People do go to the branch, and it's a pain to have to drive. In the case of First Midwest. Before a resource came along, people were going to have to drive sort of 20 minutes away to go to the bank, which, you know, isn't the end of the world, I suppose, but it's in terms of their way of life and what their sort of daily routines were like, it's going to change things.
And that relationship too, as we've been talking about.
Yeah, Right. It just makes more – in terms of the town and whether the Littleton – we're talking about sort of a couple of blocks of retail, right? So in terms of the town and whether it feels vital, whether it feels like it's doing okay and thriving, I think it's almost as much that as it is the actual banking services, which you can continue to get even when a branch closes.
Well, we'll see what happens with Leland, Steve. Thanks for reporting on it. We're going to tweet out his story, so eventually there will be some conclusion here. But I want to thank Mike Doherty for being with us as well, giving us a little of the farm perspective with the Illinois Farm Bureau, and Carol Jo Fritz, president of First Neighbor Bank. All of you, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Adam Ragusea has been in the public radio world for years. He worked at NPR stations all over the country, including WBUR in Boston and at Georgia Public Broadcasting. And most recently, he's been a professor of journalism at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia. But in the past few months, his career has taken an unexpected turn into the world of YouTube.
For 10 years, I've been trying to make real New York-style pizza at home, and I think that I've gotten as close as I'm ever going to get. At the very least, this is a damn good pizza, authentic or not. For the dough, start with a teaspoon of yeast, a teaspoon of sugar.
Adam uploaded that back in December when he started to produce cooking videos, and since then, it's gotten more than 5.1 million views. His following on YouTube has only grown since December. His channel has nearly 350,000 subscribers. His fans say they like his straightforward style. One commenter said, quote, "doesn't skip important bits, straight to the point. Good job, sir. Keep it up." And now the journalist and professor is turning his YouTube channel into his full-time job. And Adam's on the line with us now from Georgia Public Broadcasting. Hi, Adam. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, Niall. Thanks for having me on.
So, Adam, can you tell us a little bit more about what you did in public radio before all of this happened?
I was a reporter and host, much like yourself, working at various places around the country. When I moved to Georgia, there was a dearth of reporters filing to the national network. So I did a lot of national work for NPR from this part of the country. And then I, you know, gradually transitioned over to teaching, and that was wonderful. But this recent weirdness in my career is kind of an outgrowth of that teaching. We have a very multi-platform program here at Mercer. I have to teach, video and audio and programming and all kinds of things. And, you know, video was certainly a weak point in my skill set. I had enough video skills that I could turn a 90-second traditional TV news package, no problem, but I hadn't really done much more complex than that. So just to kind of get myself improving my skills, I gave myself an assignment that I knew I would do because I thought it'd be fun. So I just took home some camera gear from school and shot a cooking video just to get to better know my camera a little bit. And I did three of them, and one of them was that pizza video that just randomly took off in March for reasons I still can't really discern. When you've been around the media production business as long as you and I have, you know that, whether you intended to cook on the internet professionally or not, when you suddenly have an audience of literally millions around the world, it doesn't matter. it has chosen you, right? And you keep going. So that's what I've been doing. I've been doing two videos a week now for a little while, and it makes more money than anything I've ever done in media by an order of magnitude. And it's super weird, but great.
So I want to talk to you a little bit more about that. But first, I want to ask you, why did you pick cooking? Have you always loved cooking?
Yeah. It's a hobby for me, like as it is for a lot of people. I suppose I'm a bit of a serial tinkerer, right? Like a habitual tinkerer, right? Like so, I anything that I work on, anything creative that I do, I tend to try to improve it rather systematically and keep records of, you know, how I've done it in the past and blah, 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 blah. And certainly my work in the kitchen would fall under that heading. But no, I'm like, you know, I'm not a restaurant chef or anything like that. I'm just sort of an avid home cook. But frankly, I think that's part of what I like about my YouTube channel and what I think maybe some other people like about it is that it is absolutely about home cooking. It has nothing to do with what people in the restaurant industry do. And certainly one of my bugaboos my entire cooking life has been that I really feel like home cooking has been infected with a lot of ideas from professional chefery. Which
a lot of
I
nonsense,
largely...
it sounds like you want to say, Adam.
I want to say nonsense, but I mean, just things that are inapplicable, right? A lot of just things that professional chefs do that they have introduced into the public consciousness via the celebrity chef movement and Food Network and all of that kind of stuff that makes a lot of sense for a professional kitchen, but really has nothing to do with cooking food in your house for your kids. And my channel is exclusively about that. And often I think to the frustration of professional chefs who watch my channel and don't like what they see, and they leave nasty comments, and
what have they said?
Struggling to come up with a good example.
Well, why do you think about that? Oh, go ahead.
Well, so for the pizza thing, right? In that pizza video, I put the water and the yeast together, and I let the yeast bloom. And then I start putting in the other ingredients for the dough, which includes salt. And I put the salt directly into the water that contains the bloomed yeast. And in a professional kitchen, that's a no-no because salt is antimicrobial and it can kill yeast. And that's true, right? But manifestly, it didn't kill my yeast because my dough rises, right? But that's a really good, if you're running a professional kitchen, that's a really good rule to give your employees to say, don't put the salt in with the blooming water, right? Put the salt onto the flour instead. Because if you're managing employees, you don't know how long they're going to let that salt sit in that water. Like it could sit there for an hour while the employee goes and does another thing and it could kill all the yeast. But in a home cooking situation, no, I'm making the dough right then and there. Yeah, I put the salt into the water and yeah, it could conceivably start killing the yeast, but I'm going to put in 5 cups of flour immediately afterward that is going to immediately dilute the salinity of the solution. And it's easier to integrate the salt if you put it straight into the water. So it's fine, right? But like it still made a whole bunch of professional cooks' heads explode because it's not what they're told to do in their workplace. And initially, I was really kind of plucky in my responses to them, and I sort of regret that. I want to be nice, and everyone's coming from, you know, a legitimate place on this issue, but really just things work differently in a home kitchen.
And I want to ask you just about, Adam, how you handle that, because when you get to a point where, first of all, as of this morning, by the way, that pizza video had 5.1 million views. I wonder, first of all, what was going through your head or your mind when you, in March you started to see this video really kind of start to blow up?
I don't know. I mean, as a media creator, I've gone viral before, right? Like I've had individual articles that I've written for various news organizations blow up for one reason or another. It's not new to me, and this, fortunately, you know, it's not like a political thing. You know, I've done political coverage where I got death threats, you know, things I had to report to the police and things like that from people. And this was relatively inoffensive. On the other hand, like I still got a lot of hate mail as a result of that video and continue to do so. A lot of it from Italians who don't like what I've done to what they consider to be a national dish. A lot of them just are confused by the idea, because the idea of New York style pizza, which is what I called it, because they're unclear on how in the United States, when we say New York style pizza, we basically mean a flat pizza as opposed to a Chicago style pizza, which is a quote unquote food that I imagine some people in your audience are familiar with.
Choose
not to recognize
all
it.
All right.
It's a casserole, not a pizza. Anyway, it really inflamed a lot of passions. To answer your question, I was like, huh, this is interesting. This is neat. I think it underlines for me that when you do create content or make any kind of creative work that you put on the internet, you have to be cognizant that anything that you make could, for whatever reason, blow up and become the thing that they carve on your tombstone, right? And that's especially kind of terrifying for people at, say, Illinois Public Media, who are just sitting there pumping out, you know, a story or two a day. It doesn't, you know, you're just kind of feeding the beast and creating content at an incredibly fast pace. And it might not occur to you that one of those stories that you just tossed off without a whole lot of thought could potentially just take the world by storm and it becomes the thing that defines you. But that's a reality that you have to live with. And
particularly right in this media environment, right, Adam?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm speaking with Adam Regosia. He's a journalism professor at Mercer University, former longtime public radio journalist, now running, as he's telling us, the story of how he's turned into this, as he's created this YouTube cooking channel. And Adam, I wanted to play another clip from a different video because it kind of gets to this style that you were talking about, where you not just post recipe videos, but then you also talk about some common cooking questions or myths. And one of them is about whether or not alcohol really burns off when you cook. And you actually talked to a chemistry professor named Garland Crawford about that.
According to the literature, depending on what you're looking at and some of your technique you're using, what we do know is there's always going to be some residual amount of alcohol left.
This stands in contrast with what many of the world's great chefs erroneously believe, including my beloved Marco Pierre White.
We put the second batch of sauté in, brought it up to the boil.
You want no reduction as the second session?
No, just brought to the boil, just to burn off the alcohol.
Yes, alcohol boils off at a little lower temperature than water, but that doesn't mean it boils off instantaneously. I mean, think about it. When you bring a pot of water to a boil, does the water suddenly just go poof and vanish?
It's a video from the YouTube channel of Adam Regosia. Adam, what made you, when you think about your journalism skills, I wonder how much you bring to that now when you're producing these videos, because they are very, in a way, I do feel like there's some very straightforward questions that you're researching like a journalist here.
Sure, yeah. So on Thursdays, I upload a recipe video, and that I wouldn't consider that journalism. On Mondays, I do some other kind of video about food that's not a recipe. And usually that's sort of answering some common kitchen question, like when I cook with wine, does it all boil out? Is it safe for me to give this to my kids? Is it going to make my kids drunk or something like that? And, you know, I would consider that to be journalism. Certainly I'm using all of my skills as a journalist. I mean, there was one video I did where I was sort of looking at the best way to warm plates at home. I think this is actually a really good idea from the restaurant industry to import into the home, which is like warm your plate before you put food on it. It's amazing how effective that is at improving your meal. But I was trying to figure out what's the best way. And I've often microwaved empty ceramic plates. And a lot of my viewers have said, hey, that's not safe. So I figured, oh, let me get an expert to weigh in on this. And so I found a material scientist at MIT and got her on the line and had her answer the question for me. And it was my skills as a journalist that I knew how to find the media relations person at MIT, and I knew how to talk to that person and persuade them to give me access to one of their experts, right? Those are all kind of journalism skills. I suppose the only thing that makes it not journalism is that they're not timely, right? There's no peg, right? It wasn't that, you know, some person in Bloomington, Illinois, microwave exploded while they were.
So how do you answer? So how did you figure out? I mean, in the UK, everyone just puts them on the plate warmer setting in their oven, but they don't have that here.
There's a plate warmer setting on the oven.
Mm-hmm. Yep, because everyone in the UK warms plates. It's like a thing.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's
cold there.
Yeah, I think probably like the best way is to, if you already got your oven hot, you know, just put it in there. Just be aware that if the oven is really hot, like at cooking food temperatures, it's going to get the plate really, really hot, really, really fast. So just put it in there for a second and probably use an oven mitt when you take it out. But like, it's not going to hurt the plate. I mean, a ceramic plate was fired in a 2000 degree kiln, right? It's going to handle 350 Fahrenheit just fine.
So,
but gosh, that's a whole thing right there.
Now you have a whole other, great, I gave you a whole other YouTube video. So I just wanted to end by asking you, you said that you're at the point where you're actually making more money from YouTube than you did as a journalism professor. And I feel like it's tempting to draw some conclusions about the state of journalism when a journalism professor leaves his full-time job to become a YouTube cooking star. But I'm sure you thought about that before you made your decision to leave.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that Well, no, I wouldn't read too much. Oh, gosh, how do I answer this? I would consider those Monday videos to still be, I'm creating informational, educational content, whether you want to call it journalism or not, is really not a distinction that even matters to me at this point. So I'm thrilled that, you know, informational content can make money and be sustainable in an ecosystem like YouTube that places ads automatically against your content and gives you 50% of the ad revenue. I think that's great. You know, it's also the case that part of the reason why this makes enough money is that it's content that is accessible to and of interest to a global audience that I can aggregate across the entire world, right? Whereas if you're trying to make local journalism for people in downstate Illinois, like there's only so many people who are going to be of interest to whom that is going to be of interest, and it's much harder to just achieve the scale necessary to make substantial amounts of money from that. And that's just the reality. And I've really lost hope for a market solution to the local news problem. I think it's really going to be purely about philanthropy, making local news happen.
And in the meantime, it is very encouraging to hear about the content and creating good content on YouTube. So thanks so much for taking the time to be with us, Adam Ragusea. You can find his YouTube channel. We'll tweet it out. We'll have it up at 21stshow.org as well. Adam, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Nyla. Good luck up in Michigan.
Thank you so much. That does it for us today. You can head to 21stshow.org for more information about us. Tomorrow, I'm going to be sitting down with Illinois author Nafisa Thompson-Spires before she leaves Illinois. We're going to talk about her debut novel, a collection of short stories, Heads of the Colored People. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.